little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same. Choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a hearty Thursday afternoon to you, or evening, I guess it is. This is Bob Frelick, and you tuned into a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. I'm with
host Julia Minton, co-host. Always happy to be here.
Oh, well, that's good. You look happy tonight. You know, we've got that song. I never get tired of that song.
I love that song.
Think for Yourself. And I've been looking into having George Harab, who wrote that song,
be so great
as a guest. And it would be a kind of a different show because we're a little more serious and we get academic sometimes.
Oh, and the professors, oh, man. And blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. And George Harab is a musician, a poet, a songwriter. He owns a record label. He's a drummer. He's a skeptic. He's a comic.
What do musicians and poets have to do with critical thinking? This is
He could tell us, maybe, you know. I would have a hard time making in the transition to a show that light, but I don't think you would.
Well, I like the idea because originally you and I arm wrestled as to whether it should be Frank Zappa, and George Harab won out, and at least we can have him join us someday. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Think for Yourself is our theme song, and he has given us graciously given us permission to use that song.
It's like love from the critical thinking community.
It is. And we're contactable. You can reach us. You want to tell them how?
Oh, yeah. There's a number of ways with the amazing invention of the interwebs. Most of all, you can find us on Facebook, where Bob diligently puts our promos, letting you know what we're going to be talking about at the next show. If you're on Facebook, just look up Critical Thinking Radio, and it should come right up.
Or Thinking Clearly Radio, right?
That's what I said, isn't it?
Oh, close. Oh. Thinking Clearly Radio, yeah.
Thinking Clearly Radio.
Right.
We're on Facebook. We make regular posts. Bob and I are real people, and we love to hear from our audience.
We do. You give us good ideas when you contact us and say, you know, you've never done a show on blah, 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 and then we put blah, blah, blah right on our list.
You did do a show on blah, 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 but you forgot blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly.
We do love hearing from our audience. So please feel free to contact us. Let us know what you think about our shows or ideas for future shows or just things in the realm of critical thinking you think we should be aware of.
All right. And you can also go back to any of our previous shows. This is our 28th episode.
No way.
It is. Way.
Wow.
And you can get any of those, any or all of those episodes by going to our podcast version of this show. And you can get that at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. Libsyn is spelled L-I-B-S-Y-N. Thinking Clearly is one word, so it's thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
And you know what I do is I have a podcast app on my phone, and I just go to my podcast app, and I say add feed, and I search Thinking Clearly, and we're the only ones. You subscribe to the Thinking Clearly feed, and your podcast app will make sure that it's always up to date with our shows.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, you know what? You probably didn't know this because I snuck this in, but I do have a quote for the month.
Oh, boy.
And it caught my eye because, you know, I wait like a little boy for Discover magazine to come and Scientific American, and then I do a little dance and I just start reading those suckers. And in the last edition of Scientific American, something caught my eye. And it was a conversation with one of the few scientists whose name is Representative Bill Foster from Illinois. And he was talking about the...
Wait, a political person who's also a scientist?
He is. And there's not many of them, folks.
Wow.
And that's what the article was all about.
We need more of them.
We do, and he thinks so too. He was talking about that, the lack of members of Congress with academic backgrounds in science at a time when scientific evaluation is so critical for government policies to be science-based and for emerging technologies. He has a PhD in physics. He gets overwhelmed because he's the go-to person for all these colleagues. They're always going, you know, can you tell us about this? Fill us in. What does this mean? And all that kind of stuff. And so there was an interview with him, a short interview in the Scientific American. And one of his comments really stuck out to me because it's a real important theme of this show is to learn and practice critical thinking because our opinions and beliefs are constantly being manipulated by others, by corporations who want to sell us things, by politicians who want our vote, by people who want us to believe certain things. And so we've talked about and used this term critical thinking as cognitive self-defense. Mm-hmm. So that's what caught my eye. Here's the quote from Representative Bill Foster. He says, quote, politics is very different from science. Because in science, you stand up and say something. If you stand up and say something you know is not true, it's a career-ending move. It used to be that way in politics, he says. It has taken me a while to adjust to politics where for many who practice it, the question is not, is it true, but what can I convince the voting public is true?
I'm trying not to
laugh. Some humor on your face.
I'm trying not to laugh inappropriately. So I'm kind of crying at the same time.
Oh. And what's that's an emotional wave that just came over you. What happened?
Well, it's so true. It's just it couldn't be more true. And it raises in me is and we've all heard it. I'm entitled to my opinion. And that is true. You are entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your facts. And I think that is a desperate, desperate difference between politics and science, a very good point that he makes, mm-hmm. and exactly why we need, this is me laughing and crying, why we need some science and some politics, man. We need some evidence-based.
I'm getting fair clamped here.
It's just been such a week.
Oh, man. Well, we'll make it a better week for you.
Yeah. Can we avoid politics, Bob?
Almost exclusively.
Okay.
All right. Because the topic is not politics. It's the idea of being motivated to learn from our experience. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the hallmarks of being human and certainly an important part of what we talk about here on this show and part of the critical thinking process.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very important part if you're going to get into critical thinking, not just knowing how to look for evidence, relevant evidence, and use the principles of logic to reason to a conclusion, which is a brief definition of critical thinking. Not only that, but it also requires a mindset of wanting to know, being curious, and being willing to be a lifelong learner.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes sometimes talking about some of these subjects to actually immerse yourself in some of the basic ingredients and basic knowledge in that field, whatever it is. So at any rate, tonight...
What are we doing here tonight?
I thought it would be a good idea if we think back over our 27 previous episodes and think about what are our top, two or three, doesn't matter how many, but top things that we think are the most important things that we've learned from doing this show.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully the listeners have learned some things from listening to the show, but I know it's been a great learning experience for me doing this show.
Mm-hmm, me too. In fact, you've already touched on one of the things I brought today.
Oh, what is that?
Are you ready? Can we get
I'm
in?
I'm ready.
We're getting
into
number one?
We can right now.
All right. My number one was remaining open to new information.
All right.
We've done a lot to shore up, especially early on in our show. I still can't believe it's been 28. This is number 28?
Yep.
Wow. Well, I'm going to assume that's evidence-based because it's coming from you, but I could verify if I wanted to.
You could. You could look at our podcast list for one thing. thinkingclearly.lipson.com.
Good plug, Bob. Remaining open to new information, because something that got me thinking early on, and in maybe the first half dozen shows we tackled, making logical arguments, deduction, induction, that sort of riveting material that we brought to the airwaves. And I think that stuff's really important. I'm not dismissing it at all. It can really shore up your argument. It can help you shore up other people's arguments. It can also bring you a certain confidence from the position you're coming from. But when you have a stack of evidence, and even when you have every reason to be confident, there is every opportunity for new information to come along that will make you reconsider. Mm-hmm. And being open to that new information, because I feel like one of the greatest travesties I could do is be approached with new information and disregard it. That is just
rejected out of hand.
Talk about living in the past, yeah. You know? But also it's, again, this is, I think, going to be my theme tonight, is it's a balance. There is a time to say, you know, I'm coming from an evidence-based position with, I've thought my argument out well, and I have reason to be confident in it, balancing that with, but I'm still available for new information that will inform my opinion.
Very good. And I would heartily endorse that. You know, I would agree with that because I see too often that when people are presented with new information, they're already putting a wall up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Somebody funded that research, exactly. And that's why it's not true. Yeah,
It's the big corporations or government or the other party.
So-and-so said that, of course.
Yeah.
And I would expect that.
I would expect that from them.
But there's that, I mean, that might be true. So-and-so researched something and there's a result that would be amenable to the people, to the funders. But you as the person researching that argument, can dig in and say, well, where did that come from? How did they come to that evidence? There's no reason for the rejection of that evidence to stop simply because of one or two factors.
Yeah, because it's really a mindset, I think, and it takes a shift away from trying to defend our beliefs, trying to actually be curious about this new information and curious as to whether our beliefs should be modified or maybe completely turned around, you know. But usually we'll, a little at a time, maybe modify our beliefs with new information. And that's the whole idea, because the idea is that we're trying to get closer and closer to the truth, not just the truth for our group or our tribe or the people that we agree with or admire, but the truth of the matter, if it is a matter that has truth. And that's one of the things I'll talk about a little later as to one of the things I've learned. Some matters have real truths. Those are the is questions. And some matters have very debatable value-based truths to them. And those are kind of entirely more murky arguments as far as I'm concerned. But we'll get into that. That's kind of my third choice. Can I go to my first choice?
Oh, please.
All right. My first choice is that, and I do have a background in psychology, but that was years and years back. So the idea is that I've updated I thought I was done with, psychology.
You figured it all out.
Been there, done that, you know. But there has been so much interesting work, you know, that I have found once I started getting into doing some research for this show. And so my first choice that got me back into some of the studies in social science, whether you want to call it psychology or cognitive science or neuroscience, social science, economics even, that have been looking for evidence for how people really think. Mm-hmm. Now, philosophers have struggled for years as to how we should think, mm-hmm. you know, to reach the truth. But psychologists take a more, what we call, descriptive look at things, and they describe and do experiments and studies on how people do think, you know, how do they come to their beliefs. And that has been eye-opening to me in terms of all the new research that's coming out, many, many books on that, many, many studies. And we've talked before about this, but I really hadn't thought about it all that much before. The two main ways that we approach, decision-making, coming up with answers and that sort of thing. What have we called those?
Flipping a coin and rock, paper, scissor. Those are the two types, yeah. Right? That's how I make decisions.
Yeah. Okay. Bob and Julia comedy show here tonight.
You're thinking of the FAST system, which is like intuitive, it's reflexive, and the SLOW system, which is the methodical, analytical, the stuff we do here.
Yes. Well, we do some fast thinking here too, because
that's true.
Oftentimes, if I'm saying something, you'll do a quick hit on it, and you're tapping into your intuitive. You haven't had time to research that and take it through a logical thought process. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times we use both of these, of course, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
System one and system two.
System one and system two.
I just can't remember which one's which. So I like fast and slow thinking.
Okay. Well, system one is the fast one. System two is the slow, deliberate system. And the way I think about those two systems is that, and we're going to hear a clip in a moment by Kevin De La Plante, who's a two-time guest with us, who does a very good job of talking about at least part of that, which is called heuristics, which are shortcuts that we use in that intuitive fast system.
Rule of thumb, as they say.
Rule of thumb or heuristics. And when they go bad, they're called biases. And there's been so much research on that showing that we are very, very quick to come to a conclusion, and often it's wrong because of a bias that we have that takes us in a direction that if we study it, if we take more time, more thought about it, use techniques to come to answers, we might see it completely different. And oftentimes our quick intuitive hits on things are quite on. And those were we evolved with those. And they were survival factors for us, right? You can't sit around and think a lot about being attacked by a saber-toothed tiger.
Here comes a tiger. I wonder if it just wants to get pet or if it wants to eat me.
Right.
But I don't know. Maybe.
Let me check the records.
Let me check the records.
Yeah. Right. And we still use that. I mean, if you don't sit around and think about the pros and cons of touching a hot stove, right?
I try not to.
Yeah, it's very reflective. Once you learn that stove is hot, that's it. No more study has to be made as to whether, well, I wonder if it's, you know, going to be hot and burn me this time. You know, we know those things.
Mm-hmm.
They get us through life. Mm-hmm. We do most or a lot, probably the majority of our decision making with that fast intuitive system. In fact, that's what Jonathan Haidt, who wrote a book, what's that called? The Righteous Mind. Very good book. One of the books I'd recommend if you want to get into these issues. Jonathan Haidt, it's Haidt, The Righteous Mind. And he uses a metaphor to distinguish between this intuitive and deliberate system. He calls it the elephant and the rider.
Hmm.
The elephant, though, is the fast, quick, intuitive system, and is really in charge. The rider sometimes can override the elephant's momentum.
Mm.
And that rider is our more deliberate self. So Jonathan Haidt kind of takes that angle on it. The other book that I'd recommend and metaphor that comes into play here is by Joshua Green, and he's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and he wrote the book called Moral Tribes. And he uses this dual model that we're talking about, System 1 and System 2. He uses a modern automatic camera, okay? And you have both a manual setting and an automatic setting. And the automatic setting is the intuitive System 1, which can work most of the time. I set my camera on automatic the majority of the time because I don't know enough, and it takes a lot more energy to put it on manual and then, you know, do your f-stop and your exposure time and all that kind of stuff. And in some cases, the automatic just works fine, probably the majority of cases. But
so
if you want to get the lighting just right, you want to get the camera so that it just captures a certain mood, certain colors and that kind of thing, then you got to switch it to the manual mode, the manual mode being the more complex, more labor-intensive, mm-hmm. takes more energy, takes more training. So that's the metaphor that Joshua Green uses.
I just want to let millennials know that you're talking about film cameras.
Yeah. Well, you know, on my, digital camera, there is the same thing. I have manual overrides to the automatic setting.
Okay, Bob. Fair enough.
Okay. So anyway, those are two metaphors. And some psychologists will come down on the side of, well, the intuitive is in charge. Some will come down on the side that the more deliberative system, too, is in charge. The way I look at this is that we evolved with this system one, mm-hmm. with this intuitive system. Things were simpler in those days. Our decisions were easier. They were less complex.
True. We died younger.
We did, yeah. And in these days, the decisions and the things we have to deal with are much more complex. Uh-huh. And so our culture, our ability to cooperate among each other
our
as a
social
species,
mind.
Our social minds, which again evolved. Primates and other animals, some other animals have social groups and social behaviors that are complex, but nothing like ours and nothing like the kind of cooperation that our species mm-hmm. has developed.
So I'm curious, you say you come from a background in psychology, you're a counselor, and then you retired and then you started learning about this stuff. Could you talk a little bit more about the changes, how you had to update what your understanding of human psychology, to your point about?
Well, some of that, when I was in the field, some of that was being researched. I won't say that, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, say that there was none of that research being done. But the research has really accelerated a lot, having to do with heuristics, biases, the way people perceive. Economics has done a lot on that. It used to be that economics thought we were rational actors, right? That was their assumption, that everybody made decisions based on just what was best for them mm-hmm. and what worked for them. And then talked about Daniel Kahneman. He came along and got some research going that influenced economics to the point that it became known as behavioral economics. Mm-hmm. And so
that was sort of the shift that took place.
It's a shift, yeah, yeah. And so there was there's lots more updates, but what I was amazed by is the amount of research that's done now on metacognition, on how we think, and involves even technology like
fMRIs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That where you can look at the brain when someone's actually looking at a picture or thinking about something in particular.
Right. And tell which parts of the brain are active. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's a good point.
Well, those are, you know, those are some of the ideas and things that I have been amazed and thrilled actually to learn more about in doing this show. So let's go ahead and listen to Kevin De La Plante, short clip of him talking about heuristics and biases.
30 years, we've learned an awful lot about human reasoning and decision-making. Now, a lot of this research was stimulated by the work of two important researchers, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, going back to the early 1970s. They laid the foundations for what is now called the biases and heuristics tradition in psychology. Now, to get a feel for the importance of this research, let's back up a bit. When studying human reasoning, you can ask two sorts of questions. One is a purely descriptive question. How do human beings, in fact, reason? The other is a prescriptive or normative question. How should human beings reason? What's the difference between good reasoning and bad reasoning? Now, when we study logic and argumentation, we're learning a set of rules and concepts that attempt to answer this second question, how should we reason? These are elements of a broader normative theory of rationality, of what it means to reason well. Before Kahneman and Tversky's work in the 1970s, there was a widely shared view that, more often than not, the mind, or the brain, processes information in ways that mimic the formal models of reasoning and decision-making that were familiar from our normative models of reasoning, from formal logic, from probability theory, from decision theory. What Kahneman and Tversky showed is that, more often than not, this is not the way our minds work. They showed that there's a gap between how our normative theories say we should reason and how we in fact reason. This gap can manifest itself in different ways, and there's no one single explanation for it. One reason, for example, is that in real-world situations, the reasoning processes prescribed by our normative theories of rationality can be computationally very intensive. Our brains would need to process an awful lot of information to implement our best normative theories of reasoning. But this kind of information processing takes time, and in the real world, we often need to make decisions much quicker, sometimes in milliseconds. You can imagine this time pressure being even more intense if you think about the situations facing our Homo sapien ancestors. If there's a big animal charging you and you wait too long to figure out what to do, you're dead. So, the speculation is that our brains have evolved various shortcut mechanisms for making decisions. Especially when the problems we're facing are complex, we have incomplete information, and there's risk involved. In these situations, we sample the information available to us. We focus on just those bits that are most relevant to our decision task, and we make a decision based on a rule of thumb or a shortcut that just does the job. These rules of thumb are the heuristics in the so-called biases and heuristics literature. Now, two important things to note here. One is that we're usually not consciously aware of the heuristics that we're using or the information that we're focusing on. Most of this is going on below the surface. The second thing to note is that these heuristics aren't designed to give us the best solutions to our decision problems, all things considered. What they're designed to do is give us solutions that are good enough for our immediate purposes. But good enough might mean good enough in our ancestral environments where these cognitive mechanisms evolved. In contexts that are more removed from these ancestral environments, we can end up making systematically bad choices or errors in reasoning because we're automatically, subconsciously invoking the heuristic in a situation where that heuristic isn't necessarily the best rule to follow. So the term bias in this context refers to this systematic gap between how we're actually disposed to behave or reason and how we ought to behave or reason by the standards of some normative theory of reasoning or decision making. The heuristic is the rule of thumb that we're using to make the decision or the judgment. The bias is the predictable effect of using that rule of thumb in situations where it doesn't give an optimal result.
Here's an open question. I think this relates to something that you and I were talking about before the show started, Julia. That's the idea that, okay, we have this system one, fast, intuitive system, but that can be sometimes fallible. We have the more deliberate, thought out, kind of like critical thinking system two, that is more appropriate for more complex questions. So the question is, and I think it's an open question really in studies too, is how do we figure out when it's appropriate? How do we have an awareness that we have these two systems and figure out when it's appropriate to use one over the other and learn to do that and go back and forth between that balance? Isn't that part of what you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, actually, that gets into my next point, my number two point, which is I haven't figured that out. I
haven't either.
That, to me, in thinking about that, was it's a balance to be a whole, well-rounded human being in society, in this world. You have to have both. You have to have the fast and the slow, the system one, the system two. And I think sometimes when I talk with listeners, that's a misunderstanding, that we're here only advocating for system two slow thinking. That, well, that is kind of what we're here to do, but we're not saying that's the only way. And that there is, I think, part of our, forgive me for saying, conscious evolution is knowing, learning, sharing information about which is appropriate and when. When my house is on fire, I'm not going to slowly deliberate the best way to put it out, how the fire started, da-da-da-da-da. No, I'm going to put the damn fire out, you know? Mm-hmm. However, if I'm making a choice that may affect the rest of my life, a career choice, a life choice, a family choice, that is something that I'm going to listen to my gut, as it were, my intuition, but it's not something I'm going to jump at quickly. I'm going to be deliberate about, but you know what? That's never really fully figured out. I don't think it's ever going to be. I just hope to get a little bit closer.
Yeah. And I think that's the frontier of research in this area, when they start understanding how it works well enough to then go through how we can apply it to come to better judgments and get along better and cooperate better and solve our challenges together. And I think it's really interesting. That's why I call it an open question. And I had a similar experience that you just described, in that I talked to somebody who listens to this show at an event, and we got into a lengthy discussion, and the essence of what he was saying is, yeah, I listened to your show, but you're trying to tell us how stupid we are all the time. that kind of took me aback, and only emphasizing that to so that we can all become aware of our foibles and our vulnerabilities, so we can move past them. And so what I wanted, and kind of a point I wanted to not leave out of this first thing that I've learned a lot about, is that I want to correct the impression that I think intuitive, fast processes are completely flawed all the time. And that they're very, very limited, and that we should almost always engage our cognitive, rational, deliberative processes. I will admit to a bias of biases, meaning that I tend to pull back sometimes and think about things and challenge my own first belief. But in order to get some balance on that, we're going to have a guest next month whose name is Gary Klein. And Gary Klein is that guy who wrote the article with Kahneman that we talked about on a previous show, where they got together, Klein and Kahneman, and they're coming from completely different sides of it. Kahneman does experiments in the laboratory to try to figure out what people's biases are. And Klein does studies in the field with experts and people who have shown expertise in a number of different areas. And the book that he wrote about 3 or 4 years ago was on insights and how people get insights. So Klein is very much of the, well, you can't learn everything in the laboratory. You have to go out and really see in real life how people are thinking to appreciate the intuitive skills that people have. And so that should be really interesting. I'm looking very forward to Gary Klein coming in and giving me a little balance.
So that's the first Thursday of November.
Yeah. And okay, so do you have anything else to add?
No, I just, to drive that point home, that we are here to talk about a particular type of thinking and the tools that come along with that, but we're not saying that that's what everything's all about. There's certainly a time and a place. Since you opened the show with politics, it does lead me to think of a particular historic political leader who was commonly referred to as a guy who came from his gut, who said what he thought, and the kind of political representative we could have a beer with. And to that I ask, is that an appropriate application of System 1 versus System 2 thinking? Is that the right place to cultivate fast thinking?
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. Balance is always an important thing to keep in mind. Okay, well, I want to get to the second thing that I really appreciated learning about, and that's the difference between is and ought. The is and ought. We've talked about this on a whole other single show, and we used an example to work that through. But it was really a revelation to me that many of the issues that are controversial or issues that come up, in social media or the newspaper or our discussions, really are not just about the way the world is. They also include things that have to do with human values, morals, or ethics, which has to the idea of how should the world be. Mm-hmm. It was a surprise to me that there's a whole different literature in philosophy on how to do moral reasoning. And it's not as straightforward and cut and dry as looking at evidence and applying rules of logic and coming to our conclusions to find out how the world is. The difference is that, for example, let's say we're faced with an issue, and this is a real-life issue that has happened. There are some folks that believe that their children's life and health are in the hands of God, and that God's will be done, and refuse medical treatment and offer prayer for their children, but refuse medical treatment. And that still happens. It sounds like it's something that doesn't happen, but it happened just last year. And the parents got charged with manslaughter for doing that. So that's an argument that has two parts to it. The first part is this medical treatment effective for treating the child's illness? That's an is question. Mm-hmm. Pretty straightforward, although hard to do. You have to do controlled research studies to see if it's safe and effective. But it's doable with good research and trying to replicate studies. It's doable. It's cut and dry as to once you define the criteria for safe and effective, then because no drug is completely safe or completely effective. Mm-hmm. But once you define what those levels are, then you can determine with the best evidence that you can get whether it's safe and effective. And it's fact. It's either safe and effective or it's not safe and effective, or there's not enough evidence to determine it. But let's say that that part of the argument came out in the affirmative and that there is a safe and effective drug. Now we get into a question of values. Should parents be required by law and face criminal punishment if they don't get treatment for their children? That's a whole different argument. There's no fact about that. That involves human values, human judgments. It's more subjective, not as cut and dry as to how we reason that through. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I'm hoping to do down the line in terms of the future is to get a philosopher who knows about moral reasoning and see if we can get them to give a brief tour of the kinds of reasoning that we get into. Now, because I had the feeling that many, many more arguments than I was ever aware of involve ought questions, I tried to figure out how to figure that out. So what I did is I went to a website that's called procon.org, and their mission is to promote critical thinking education by presenting controversial issues in a straightforward, nonpartisan pro-con format. And they had several categories of arguments that they had. So I just picked one, which is the 10 most popular arguments. And here's some examples. Should more gun control laws be enacted? Should animals be used for scientific commercial and testing? In fact, 9 out of the 10 that they listed were shoulds. Mm-hmm. Moral arguments, ethical arguments. So it's one of the things that I want to encourage listeners to do is to take a look at arguments that are out there and try to see if you can distinguish between the is parts of those and the ought parts.
Just for our listening audience, I am over here smirking quite a bit.
You are smirking.
Because my academic career started in philosophy, and to me, I just think it's adorable that Bob has discovered philosophy.
I'm adorable. I love being called adorable.
It's like, oh, look, Bob found philosophy. Oh, how cute.
I wish this was on television so people could see how adorable I really am.
I mean, there's never a wrong time to start asking yourself very serious philosophical moral questions.
Yes. And listeners, if you take the time to investigate and look at the difference between is and ought, you can be adorable just like I am.
I got to say, it's hard, though. I mean, you're particularly adorable discovering philosophy.
Now I'm blushing.
But it is an important differentiation. And, you know, I kind of made a snarky comment earlier about how we're all entitled to our opinion. And I think, you know, this is where, especially in public dialogue and politics, we get into some really tricky situations. People choosing not to believe in climate change. Well, that's, you know, there's evidence about that. There's real good, hard evidence and science and consensus.
Yes.
And that's just not one of those.
It's not one of those intuitive, quick system one answers.
It's not, but it's also not a moral quandary.
And it's not. Yes.
The moral quandary is, do we save the humans?
Yeah.
Should we save the humans who are going to be devastated by climate change?
And if we should, how should we do that?
And I think in politics, to use that example, a lot of politicians, to avoid the moral argument, deny the facts. And simply the easy out is to say, climate change isn't a thing. So we don't have, okay, moving on.
Yeah.
When in fact, the really hard discussion comes, how do we help other people who are going to be suffering in environmental changes?
Very well put. Well, I'm going to get into one last one and be real quick with it because we want to open the phone lines for listeners to give their insights into what they've learned about critical thinking in their lives, maybe from listening to this show or otherwise. But my third insight is that a concept like intellectual empathy, similar to, steel manning or charitability, and we've talked a little bit about steel manning, which is a way of listening to a person's argument and then making sure that you're not straw manning them or, taking a weak part of their argument and knocking that down, which is called straw man, but that you are actually listening and taking the best of their argument.
The charitable argument.
The charitable argument.
I'm going to help the person I'm arguing with have the best argument they can. That way we're having the best debate we can.
Yes. And part of that I'm really interested in how it fits into critical thinking. This has been on my mind a lot, and I want to pursue it more on this show, is a thing that I'm calling intellectual empathy, which is if I'm listening to your argument, I'm listening to your belief, your discussion, I am taking the time to very intently listen not from my position, but what are you really saying? And I then reflect that back to you after you're kind of done with making your points. I'm not using that time to plan my rebuttal to your argument. And instead, I'm intently listening to you to really try to understand where you're coming from and what you're saying. And then I say that back to you in a very good and poignant summary, which tries to capture all the high points of what you've really said. And then I see if you agree. I ask you, does that seem like what you're really saying? In that way, you'll tell me if I've missed some of the points, and then I can continue to correct those. Now, hopefully, you reciprocate with me. And the point that I want to make is if we do this with each other, it's not the same as condoning the person's arguments. Because understanding a person does not mean you agree with them or you condone them, their points. It just means that you're taking the time to understand as accurately as you can what they're saying. And how that fits into critical thinking is going to be food for thought in next shows.
I'm going to acknowledge that takes a lot of mental energy. It takes emotional energy. It takes patience, active listening. It's not a default mode most of us have.
No.
And so I want to acknowledge that does take work and that takes energy to really try and understand that person, the context of their worldview.
Yeah.
And it can lead to a real meeting of minds.
And everything that we are talking about on this show takes energy and work, and so there has to be some motivation for that. So at any rate, we want to open the phone lines, 923-707, area code 923-3911. Mm-hmm. And the question is, anything we've talked about, if you want to ask us questions about what we've talked about, or if you want to tell us about what you've learned about critical thinking, that's the topic for tonight.
Yeah, so I've got my number 3, which, again, ours are really kind of close together, dovetail a little bit, slightly different. My number 3 is something that's been on my mind recently, in particular last couple shows, and in real life I've been thinking about, and this is something really that I'm continuing to process and understand, which is you talk about a meeting of minds, putting the energy into the intellectual empathy, to understanding where folks are coming from, to fully understand their argument and their point of view, and hopefully moving forward in a reciprocated way. I've been thinking a lot about when not to have dialogue. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about having civil dialogue. We've talked a lot about applying strategies, tools. I talk about patience a lot and listening to people. But I think it's also appropriate in many aspects of our lives to have boundaries.
Yeah.
And knowing when a line's been crossed.
Maybe we'll have a caller who will who will have a similar question, and I want to get into that more.
Oh yeah.
I think we have our first person with an idea, which is our substitute engineer for tonight.
That is right, Bob Nate. And Julia. I'm a big fan of your show. I have learned a lot in the past 28 episodes, and I want to thank you for that right away. The one thing, my number one, which I use every day, which I've learned from your show, is the idea of having civil dialogue, which is along the same lines of what you've been talking about recently. And on one of the shows, I can't remember which, but you played a clip where a woman listed 10 rules of civil dialogue, and she said, "We're no longer listening to each other."
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that every day talking to people, conversations require balance of listening and talking, listening and talking. And I won't go through the 10 rules that she said, but I'll pick out my favorites. Number one, don't mentally multitask during the conversation. Be present in the conversation. Number six, don't equate your experiences with theirs. And number nine, listen. Listen. It's a skill. It takes effort. If you can't, you're not in conversation. Listen with intent to understand. I use this every day when I'm talking to people and conversating with people and trying to understand them and listen. And it is a skill. It takes practice. And I want to thank you. That's what the number one thing that I've taken from your show.
All
and
right.
Can I ask you, Nate, has it been more gratifying for you in trying to apply these things?
It has. It has. And I have connected more with the people that I'm conversating with. I've understood them better. I just wish other people would do the same in return.
that reciprocation, that's what I was talking about,
exactly.
is that it takes a lot of effort and energy to actually do that kind of intent listening and reflecting back, that kind of engagement. I'm optimistic that when I've tried that it is like modeling. You're modeling this kind of behavior, and it brings down the defensiveness of the other people. It's not always going to work. You're going to have some person who takes complete advantage of that. Oh, my God, somebody who's listening to me and really understands me, and they're just going to go gung-ho and never give you a chance to give your opinions and
your
ideas.
That's when I make faces.
Yeah, I'm just saying let's all experiment with that. And sometimes it'll work, sometimes it'll backfire. We're hoping that people will reciprocate.
And so often, the things we're talking about with each other, not always, but, you know, sometimes, like we started with politics, they can be things that we feel very passionately about that affect us directly and personally, bring up moral outrage. And there's nothing wrong with passion. There's really nothing wrong with passion. And sometimes in attempting to have civil dialogues with folks, it's a matter of acknowledging and appreciating that passion, but finding ways to temper it so voices aren't raised, so people can have a equality exchange of thoughts and information.
Yeah. Well, you talked a little bit about boundaries, and let's talk about what you meant by boundaries. You were talking about okay, you're willing to get into civil dialogue, but there are boundaries to that willingness or that engagement. Talk about that a little.
Oh, well, the first thing that comes to mind is name calling.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we get passionate, you know, it's easy for us to just kind of say, "Oh, Bob, you're such a white guy. Where are you coming from?" You know, or just to toss things around. And that might be true to us in that moment. So, you know, my strategy when I'm conversating with somebody who becomes derogatory or something like that is I acknowledge what, I hear you saying. That makes me a little uncomfortable. That's hard to continue this conversation, which I would like to continue. Could we find a way of toning that down? And if that's acknowledged, then you can continue proceeding. I do bring it up because, you know, right now there's a lot of difficult conversations happening about women in society. Mm-hmm. And it's some of those conversations could be harder for some than others. And it's something that people feel very passionately about on many parts of the spectrum. And I think in something that can be so sensitive and really impacts people on a lot of people on a day-to-day basis, I've seen some things get very passionate in a way that is not productive. And that's really, I think, what we're all going for here are more productive conversations, a meeting of minds, getting to know each other a little bit better.
Well, we used to call that the difference between assertion and aggression. In other words, you know, what your response was assertive when you brought it right up to the table. That I know you're passionate about that, but there's productive ways to interact with each other, and there aren't. I'm paraphrasing kind of what you said there, and that's assertive, and that can be very helpful. That's as opposed to aggressiveness, where the person just continues to name call or belittle you or dismiss your ideas constantly and that sort of thing. And yeah, we sometimes have special issues with certain people, and then it becomes, it's time for relationship therapy. But for most of the people that we're in conversation with, where we're talking to friends or we're talking, well, family members, sometimes we have, that's why we have keep the family therapist, in business. So there's kind of a shade in between something that really needs some more in-depth relationship counseling versus being able to work it out on a one-to-one basis. So maybe that's what you mean by the boundaries, is that you will come up against a point where with a person you can see that this is not going anywhere.
Well,
it's not going to be productive.
Sometimes it starts there.
Yeah, and it starts there, but you're willing to, it sounds like you're willing to acknowledge what's happening. Yeah.
And sometimes I'm more willing than others. I mean, because of this show, I've on occasion had folks come up to me and feel that they're completely entitled to be as passionate as they see fit because I'm apparently a logic robot. And it takes work and energy on my part to, okay, first we have to set some ground rules. I'm in the produce section of the market. You're raising your voice. I'm not the person you think I am. Is that a conversation really worth having? Can we say, let's earmark this for another time? What's the point? It can be very tricky, and there's time and place. For instance, if a caller calls our show and uses words that violate our FCC license, that's a boundary. That's a boundary we have to keep because of the context of our conversation. Do we have a caller that's going to, okay.
Well. That's going to push the boundaries?
Hopefully not. I mean, we do appreciate our callers.
Yes.
But it's interesting because I don't have an answer. It's just something I've been thinking about. Yeah. It's something that, in a way, I need to do it to protect myself so that I'm not always going way above and beyond for people who are not willing to meet me halfway.
Yeah.
And also to mutually value our time together.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that by this idea of trying to understand the other person and taking the time to actually do that we should that should be everything that we do, and that we're just there to take whatever comes.
An empty vessel.
That's where the boundaries come in. But it's good for us, I think, to experiment with trying to move our conversations towards more productive ways of coming out,
And I imagine that this is my personal pendulum swing, having worked on this for 28 episodes plus. Uh-huh. This is my personal pendulum swing of putting a lot of energy into having conversations that I have to say, and the reason I asked Nate is some of the conversations that normally years ago I might have walked away from, had thought that they weren't worth the time and energy. More recently, I've spent the time and the patience to have those more difficult conversations have been immensely gratifying for a multitude of reasons. I know that person that much better. It really does kind of create a type of intimacy with someone you know, that I understand this world from a different perspective. I can see how somebody else walks through this world to an extent. And that is informative. You know, it's one thing to look in the mirror all day. It's another thing to go out and get a truly different perspective, you know, whether it's in an airplane or from a skyscraper or underwater. It's a thoroughly different perspective. And the type of patient, putting yourself in the other person's shoes conversations, I feel I've been having most of my life since exposed to philosophy. And it really has made the world to me so much more enchanted and so much more diverse than I could see with my own two eyes, and really kind of magical.
Wonderful. Well, let's, with that magical ending, thank you very much, Nate, for substituting for our regular engineer, Eric Allen, who's not here tonight, but you did a wonderful job, and thank you for listening and giving us your feedback on the show, Nate.
Thank you, you too.
Mm-hmm. You're my favorite engineer tonight, Nate.
Tonight, thank you.
Wonderful. Bye-bye.
Free for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.